Okay, so last week we discussed the first Agadata unit in Avodah Zarah, and we tried to take sort of like a global view, just to recap quickly for those who weren't here, or those who were here. The opening Gemara in Avodah Zarah, the opening Agadata has this long, what Jeffrey Rubinstein refers to, eschatological drama, meaning drama of the times of Mashiach, where it starts off and God holds the Torah to his heart, he hugs it, and he says, if you want reward, so then you have to have partaken of this Torah I hold in my heart. And each nation of the world comes to God and they say, well, we did. And he says, really, what did you do? So Rome comes and they say, well, we built marketplaces and we built all types of infrastructure. We did it only for the Jews. And God says, Shotim Sheba Olam, you fools, I know that's not why you did it. You built the marketplaces so that you could put brothels in them. You built the money doesn't impress me. I have money, who cares? And then it goes to Persia, and Persia says, well, we build roads and we build bridges. And God says, that's very nice, except you didn't do it for Torah either. You did it because you wanted to collect taxes, and goes on and on. And then after stage one, where the nations of the world try to convince God that they have partaken of Torah, they say, okay, God, it's true, we haven't partaken of Torah. That's true, but neither have the Jews. The Jews didn't, stage two is, but you didn't give us a chance. Right? We would have kept the Torah if you'd offered it to us. And God says, that's not true either. I did offer you the Torah. And then the Gemara incorporates the Midrash that God went to each nation. He said, do you want the Torah? And they said, no. So he said, okay, it's true. We didn't keep the Torah. We didn't want the Torah. The Jews didn't do it either. And God says, that's not true. They did keep it. So then they get into a quibble about how do you prove that. So God says, I'll testify that the Jews kept the Torah. And he says, no. They say, no, you can't do it. You're biased. God is your God. You are the Jews' father. You're biased. This trope, by the way, has been kept not just within sort of Jewish tradition. Has anyone ever read Mark Twain's The Jew? Most people know the last paragraph, right, where he talks about all the empires of the world that have risen, the Romans and the Greeks, and the Jew has outlasted them all. But if you look earlier in the parts that are much less famous, There's a description of a storm that happened in Germany. It was like a heavy hailstorm or something like that. And he says, I was reading the news, and it said that all these stores were destroyed, and all the houses were destroyed, and not a single Jewish house, and not a single Jewish business was damaged. And then he writes, you were once God's favorite, and it seems you've crawled back into that space once again. The nepotism makes me sick. Right, and that's the sort of the end of it. But this trope is being put here, right? That the nation of the world is saying, look, it's nepotistic. You know, they're your child. You can't tell me they kept the Torah very nice, that your word means nothing. It's like a parent saying that their child is perfect, or maybe a grandparent saying their child is perfect, or whatever the case may be. So that doesn't work. So God says, okay, fine, how about heaven and earth? Let heaven and earth testify. And they say, no, heaven and earth are biased, because heaven and earth depend on the Jews keeping the Torah. So God says, fine, you testify. And then we get a combination of every midrash that's ever existed. Nimrod will testify about Avram, that he threw himself into the fiery furnace. And Lavan will testify about Yaakov, from this week's Parsha, that he managed to keep his standards in Lavan's house. And all the protagonists of the Eov story, who no one knows their name, they will testify for whatever reason. So that doesn't work. So the fourth stage, after the couldn't justify that they had merit, and then they couldn't justify that they didn't accept that they didn't have a chance, and they couldn't undermine the credibility of the Jewish people, so they say, give us a last chance. God says, fine, I'll give you sukkah. You don't deserve it, but I'll give you a last chance. And then once he gives them the sukkah, so he pulls the sun out, it's too hot, they kick the sukkah, and they leave. And the Gemara says, well, they were allowed to, but the difference is that if a Jew had done it, he wouldn't have kicked it. It's all about attitude. The non-Jews, they kicked it. But that's sort of the summary. That's where we were. And what we'd argued last week was that the role of Agadah in general is to shed light on the values behind the halacha. Major Agadot in Masechtot shed light on the values of the Masechet itself. And since Masechet Avodah Zarah is going to devote the next 75 pages or so to explaining how we maintain difference between us and the non-Jews, the Agadot have to answer the more fundamental question, which is, well, why do we bother maintaining distinctiveness? What makes us who we are? And this Gemara is an attempt to answer that question. We summarized last week that it may come down to the Sukkah, right? That it is the opposite of everything in the beginning. The non-Jewish nations are described as having glorified themselves with infrastructure and wealth. And God says, look, that's not what's important. What's important is the simple Sukkah. Right, it's not even staying in the sukkah. Right, you could leave the sukkah as long as you have the right attitude. What's important is recognizing the value and the simple and the simplicity that's represented by the sukkah, the simple relationship with God. If you get that, that's the difference between you and the non-Jews. That's why you deserve to be who you are. And that was what we talked about last week. What I want to do this week is zero in on a piece of that Gemara, because one of the things that is key to understanding Agadah. And what, like I said, what I've been trying to do with my students at Migdal HaTorah this year is not just sort of learn Agadah with them, but try to focus on how to learn Agadah. So even when I'm learning Agadah with them, I try to focus on issues that are broader in terms of their methodological implications. So I want to zero in on one part of this Gemara. One of the things that people don't always either realize or focus on, even if they theoretically realize, because it's not necessarily easy to do this, is that Agadot are not necessarily isolated units. They're usually, or often at least, in conversation with other passages elsewhere in rabbinic literature. Right? You know, in this Agadah, it's pretty clear. Right? This Agadah, while it's one unit, it's one organic unit, integrates many other Agadot which stand alone, right? Whether it be the Jews, the non-Jewish nations rather, being offered the Torah before the Jews, or it be the Midrash of Avram in the Kivshan Ha'esh, or it be Lavan and his ability, Yaakov's ability to keep the mitzvah in the house of Lavan, right? Each of those has its own Midrashic tradition. And, you know, this is sort of, it makes sense, right? Meaning, rabbinic literature is not assuming that you're only reading this. They're assuming you're ideally immersed in the culture, right? Immersed in their traditions. If you're immersed in the traditions, so then everything means more, right? Now, I mean, we talked a little bit about this last week, that Tanakh does the same thing, right? Tanakh does the exact same thing, that parts of Tanakh are in conversation, and you can't necessarily understand a single piece of Tanakh without understanding other parts of Tanakh. Right, that's sort of the key to the entire intertextual study of Tanakh. Now, why is that? Right, why is it? Right, why would Tanakh or Shas or any literature really? Why would it not just tell you what is on its mind? Why would it force you to be immersed enough in parallel texts to understand it? Right, why would it do that? Right, what's the logic to that? Right, we know that it does that, right? I mean, you just had a Tanakh share on Esther, right? And then you'll do Daniel, you'll see they're in conversation, right? They are, right? Both of them are trying to deal with the question, how do Jews deal with Galut? They're in conversation. And there's a lot of hints between the books. But why would that happen, right? Why doesn't the Torah just tell you, you know, look, these are the ways you could deal with Galut, right? Why does it tell you different stories that force texts into conversation to get a full picture?
Maybe to relate better.
What?
To relate better.
In what sense?
Seeing what the people were really going through, to have a feeling of what it is, and just instead of having a list.
Right. So part of it, right, is that that's the nature of narrative, right? That especially in narrative. Now we do it in law also, but definitely in narrative, right? You can't just do that, right? It's much better to sort of have each story stand alone and then put them in conversation. Yeah.
Thematically, that things continue and we emerge and we can continuously learn.
Yeah, I think that's a key part of it, right? Is that it's not just that, right? At one level, right, they keep it separate rather than putting it all together because you want to experience each by itself. Part of it is because you want people to realize that they are connected, right? You want people to realize there are multiple stories. It doesn't just happen once, right? It's, we're going to read, you know, it's like, you know, if you're doing history, it's the same thing, right? You could have a you know, a class on all, you know, I don't know, the effect of nationalism, the effect of whatever on geopolitics. But you could also say, okay, let's study World War I, study World War II, and then, right, let's go back and see, right, how they are, right, how motifs repeat themselves. Another element, I think, is that it forces the reader to think, right? If you tell somebody everything, they don't necessarily think about it, right? If you spoon feed, right, so you spoon feed, you got it, and then you walk away. But if you want someone to engage with the text, so you can't do that, right? You have to hide things, or you have to make things only implicit, not explicit, because the very act of uncoding for it makes you remember it. Right? This is one of those, and it, by the way, it's not just uncoding. Anything that makes you exert effort while reading something will make you remember it. Right? They've done a lot of fascinating studies about this. I don't know if you have you ever read Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow by Kahneman? Right, so that was so okay. So people don't know this is a like a classic of modern psychology, but Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize with his partner posthumously, Amos Tversky, for basically being the fathers of much of modern psychology. So he wrote a book to summarize sort of his life's research called Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow. I think Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow. His basic argument is that the human brain functions at two levels, the intuitive level and then the sort of active cognitive level, what he calls System 1 and System 2. And much more of our life is controlled by System 1 than we admit. And a lot trying to figure out the human brain is a lot of trying to figure out how much of our life is run by intuition, by, you know, psychological heuristics, all the stuff that we do unconsciously, and how much is conscious. That was his, you know, his life's mission was to analyze the connection between the two. But one of these studies he's done is that anything that forces your more active part of the brain to engage makes you remember things because you've moved it into a different part of your brain, including making text smaller or less legible. People remember things better if they have to struggle, even if they have to squint to read something. Right? It has no connection between the content, but the very fact that you had to squint to figure out what you were reading, right, means that if something is in font 10, you're more like, and you read it, you're more likely to remember it than if it's in font 14, right? Because you put in effort, you engaged, right? That's all it takes. It was funny because when I read this passage, I think it was here, it might have been in Daniel Ariely, who's a student of that school. But when I went to the library in Thornhill, in Toronto, or outside of Toronto, they didn't have the regular edition of the book. And they only had the one for the heart of, you know, heart of sight. So everything was blown up, but whoever, you know, blew up the book didn't actually read the content. So in the original, right, it puts the next few sentences in small print to get you to remember it. But here, it was like font like 35, right? It was huge, so it totally missed the point of it. But really, it's anything, right? Anything that makes you think, makes you engage. And that's why they have done research. People remember things better if they learn it in a language that's not their first, right? If they're forced to translate it, they remember it, right? The act of translating in your head, even if you're fluent, right? The fact that you had to you translate in your head meant you went through an extra step. It meant you engaged your brain more. So the same thing is true of Tanakh. The same thing is true of Gemara. The same thing is true of everything. If we say it explicitly, you can go on autopilot, absorb it, and then as easy as it goes in, it flies out of your head. If you have to look, you have to uncover the message, so then you'll remember it. It'll penetrate. It also immerses you in a culture, right? Meaning the fact that there's an expectation that you have read other texts and that they are your go-to, right? The fact that we all know the story of Avram being thrown into the fiery furnace, and when we read it, we know all the images that are going along with it, forces us to be immersed in a culture rather than just be reading a text, which I think is also part of it. So in Agadah, often, if you want to understand it fully, you need to be aware of other texts, right? You need to know that certain conversations happen elsewhere. The last point is that sometimes the reason things will come up more than once in slightly different context is not because it's adding, but because it's presenting a dispute. Because there's actually it's multivocal, right? So to understand Haggadah, first, to get the full perspective on Haggadah, simply in terms of depth, and to get the full vocality, I mean all the voices of Chazal, you need to often be aware of parallel texts, right? And that will both deepen and vary the message that you're getting from any given Haggadah. One more point here. The Rabbi Foreman, if you know Rabbi Foreman from Aleph Beta, I don't know. Anyways, so I say some yes, some no. His way of describing why Tanakh writes this way, which I like, is you have to think about it in terms of real estate, right? If you, in Canada, I would use like Alberta versus Toronto, so I'll go with that. But in New York, whatever, right? If you want to build in the middle of, I don't know, Wyoming, right? So land is cheap. If you need to build 30, you know, houses for 30 people, so you'll build 30 houses with backyards and front yards and property, and it'll go out for, you know, miles and miles and miles and miles, and the whole thing, all 30 houses, will cost you whatever, right? $1 million, $2 million, whatever, right? If you want to do that in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, right, you don't have that choice. If you want 30 units, land is expensive. You're not going to get 150 acres in the Upper East Side. So what do? You build up, right? So he says Tanakh is the same thing, right? God's sort of conviction is that the Torah is prime territory of value forever, right? So we care about how much words we use. We don't just write. We don't just write forever, right? We pack in meaning. But how do you build up in text? By intertextuality, right? By forcing text to be in conversation, you say a lot without saying it, right? Because you have two stories, but the meaning is often what's packed in between them, right? Between in the parallels, right? In the implications of the parallels. Okay. So, with that in mind, I want to look at a parallel text. Now, the parallel text is probably more famous than the text we read last week. And the parallel text is from the well-known story of Rav Shimon bar Yochai, ending up in a cave for over a decade. Now that part of the story is very well known, that he ends up in a cave and he, you know, buries himself in sand and learns Torah and drinks water and eats caribs and great. Which of course the first question any American will ask is how could you eat that disgusting hardened caribs without realizing that it doesn't taste quite like that when it's fresh off the tree, only it's like that when they've mailed it from Israel and it's like 6 months old. But how does he end up? How does Rav Shimon bar Yochai and his son, how do they end up in the cave? Right? What's the backstory? So they run away. Now, why do they run away?
They're running from the Romans.
And why are they running from the Romans? And this is the story.
Why do they want to kill them?
Why do they want to kill them?
Was that the whole thing with the three people?
Exactly. Right? Perfect. So, that's source one. Right? There's three people sitting there. A conversation. And that's what's in source one, right? Vamai karle roshem v'dabrim b'chol makom. So we have Rabbi Huda ben Garim, who is called the first person to speak in every place. Why? Because he spoke first in a not so great situation. Three people: the Yatve, Rabbi Huda, Rabbi Yosi, Rabbi Shimon. The other Rabbi Huda ben Garim, Gabai. Right? There are three people plus Huda ben Garim. So, Rabbi Huda, not Rabbi Huda ben Garim, Rabbi Huda himself is the first speaker. Rabbi Huda ben Garim is there. So Padach Rabbi Huda v'Amar. They're having a conversation. What are they having a conversation about? They're having a conversation about the Romans. Are they good people or not? So Padach Rabbi Huda v'Amar. Kamana imasen shel umazu. How wonderful are the actions of this nation. Tiknu shvakim, tiknu ksharim, tiknu merchatzaot. Because they've built marketplaces, bridges, and bathhouses. Now, if you remember, right, from last week, Rabbi Yehuda is personifying who in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah? The Romans, right? The Romans, when they turn to God and they say, we're great, right? We deserve reward for having done things that helped people learn Torah. They said, we built marketplaces, we built bridges, we built Mirchatzaot. Right? It's partially Rome, partially Persia. Rabbi Yossi Shatak, Rabbi Yossi just didn't say anything. Right? I don't want to get involved, I don't want to talk about it. Nenner Shimon ben Yochai v'Hamar, Rabbi Shimon is a bit more of a hothead, and he jumps in and he says, no. Kol Masha Tiknu, Lo Tiknu, Ela Litzarach Atzman. I don't care. It's true that they built all these things, but they did it for themselves. Tiknu Shvakin, Lo Shiv Behen Zonot. They made marketplaces to set up brothels, to have prostitution. Merchatzaot, La'adin Behen Atzman. Bathhouses to make themselves feel good. Ksharim Litob Mehen Meches. And bridges to take taxes. Halach Yehuda ben Garim v'siper divrehem. Yehuda ben Garim relay this message. V'nishmu l'malchut, and then it eventually got to the king. Amru Yehuda she'ila yit'ales. They said, Yehuda, who praised us, shall be elevated. Yossi sheshatak yigle litzipor. Yosef didn't want to. Rabbi Yossi didn't want to weigh in, so we won't kill him. We won't reward him. He has to leave. He can go to galut. You know. That's about a neutral punishment as we can get. Shimon shegina yehareg. But Shimon who insulted us shall be killed. Now this Gemara is literally a quote from the Gemara Nefo Dezara, except the personalities have changed. Right? In the Gemara Nefo Dezara, the Romans and the Persians come to God and say, we are righteous because we built infrastructure to help the Jews out. And God said, no, you didn't. You did it for yourself. You did it for negative purposes. You did it to indulge in hedonism. And this time, Rabbi Yehuda is playing the role of Rome and being on defense for the non-Jewish nations. And Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is in a great place because he is playing the role of God. Right? God saying, nice try. I know what is deep down, right? You didn't do it for the right reasons. So all the Mefarshim noticed this, right? It's literally a quote. It's copy and paste. So all the Mefarshim realize that these Gemaras are in conversation, right? You need to put these Gemaras in conversation. The question is, how? Right? What do you do? Right? How are they in conversation? Because you have a few problems. So what problems do we have? Right? They're clearly in conversation, but there are certain serious problems about this conversation. Right? What's wrong? What's going to bother people here?
Why is Rabbi Yehuda representing the Romans?
And
well, he went to against, and he informed.
And against God, right? Big question is, right, why does Rabbi Yehuda end up in the position defending the Romans, which, by definition, since Rabbi Shimon takes the role of God, why is he anti-God? Right, that's a big deal for the Mefarshim. They're very bothered by this, right? Meaning you have one Gemara that puts the argument that we are righteous because we did good things pragmatically in the mouth of a very respected member of Chazal, Rabbi Yehuda, and another one which puts that in the mouth of the Romans who get shot down by no less than God himself. Right? That bothers people. Right? It bothers people a lot that we can have a Gemara conversation that would have a Tana weighing in against God. It's worse than that, because in this Gemara, is it clear that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, who represents God, is right? Not clear, right? You could read it that he's right, and look how much he sacrificed to say the truth. But on the other hand, it's not totally clear, right? Meaning the end of the Gemara, right? The end of the Gemara, when Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai emerges from the cave, what does God tell him? When he comes out, go back, because he looks around, he shoots, you know, fire out of his eyes, all Superman style, right? He blows things up with his eyes because he's angry. So God says, go back in, meaning it's not like God in this Gemara is on the side of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. He wants him to mellow his approach. Now you could say, okay, he is allowed to be harsh against the Romans, he shouldn't be so harsh against the Jews, right? We could deal with it, but the point is that at first glance it's not clear that God in this Gemara is totally on Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai's side either. Right? So Rabbi Yehuda is against God, and it's not clear that God in the voice of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai gets the upper hand in this Agadah, which is problematic. For some of Mefarshim, there's an even bigger problem, which is some of Farshim, like the Netziv, believe that there can never be a machloket between Agadah at all. There can't be a machloket between Agadot, or even within Agadot. Now, why would that be true? Right? What? Right? You're looking at me like, why would that be true? Right? Why? Why would you think there can't be? Right? Why would you say there can be machloket in halacha but not in Agadah? Right? What would even drive that position?
So Agadah was supposed to help us to determine halacha, so they shouldn't have.
I mean, what? Right, but still, we have machloket in halacha, right? Why couldn't you have a machloket in Agadah?
Because it's supposed to support halacha. No clear answer.
Well, then that would support there being a machloket. Why would you say there can't be? Right? Usually, you hear the opposite, which is halacha. You have to get to an answer. Agadah.
I mean, there is not. It can't be. Means there isn't, or
like yeah, like not to be. No, there never is. Right? There, like he's philosophically opposed to the possibility. Right? Like he finds ways. He wants them to work together.
It leads to confusion of...
A confusion of? Because halacha can have machloket.
Philosophical understanding.
Yeah, about really about truth. Right? That's really what bothers him, is that halacha is normative. Right? I mean, you can have a machloket of what to do. Right? But there's something bothersome about saying there's a machloket about what Judaism is. There's one thing that we have a dispute about what to do, but to say there's a machloket about what Judaism is a bit harder to swallow. Now, not necessarily. We all know that there are constant machloket about what Judaism is, right? Like, I don't really, you know, you might not like it, but there are, right? And that's just the reality, right? Meaning, the Nesiv knew that too. It wasn't like he was not aware of this, right? Whether it be in his time, you know, the Misnagdim versus the Hasidim, right? Whatever it might be, there are machlokot, what Judaism is supposed to be about. But there are some who don't like machlokot at all. But in this one, like I said, it's even worse. Right? In this one, it's worse than that, because it's not just a machlokot. Right? It seems to be like Yehuda's against God. Now, the easiest way of dealing with this is to say, look, it's not actually God speaking, it's some member of Chazal writing an Agadata that's meant to teach you a lesson, and the member of that Agadah was of the Shem Bayochai camp. He believed that if anything isn't done with perfect intent, so it's valueless. Rabbi Huda didn't believe that. And therefore in this Gemara, you see that there's a machlokes, there's a multivocality, right? That the Gemara in Avodah Zarah believes that non-Jews are not good because they don't do things for the right reasons. And that's from Shimon bar Yochai, and Rabbi Huda didn't believe that. Right? And it turns out that the upshot of that Gemara is not accepted by all members of Chazal, right? You could just say it's a machloket, and we will suggest that possibility. But everyone took these two texts and tried to figure out, okay, so what do we do? So like I said, the easiest thing you could do is just say, look, I'm willing to swallow the possibility that there's a machloket in Agadah. I recognize that in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, God is personified as saying, you don't get reward, it's not valuable to do pragmatic things if you do it for the wrong reasons. And that is the position of whichever member of Chazal is behind the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. And the Gemara in Shabbat does not believe that. The Gemara in Shabbat tells you that that itself, right, the Gemara in Shabbat is the evidence that that is not agreed upon. Right?
There was. It doesn't say anything other than that the Romans didn't punish him. Rabbi Yehuda.
He's elevated. Right? She'ila yit'aleh. Right, he elevated us, so he shall be elevated.
Right, but that's not an endorsement of his position on a religious basis.
Oh no, the Romans endorsing him is not evidence. Right. The fact that Rishim Bayochai and what he personifies ends up being put in a cave, and then God Himself has to push them back into the cave. Right, again, it's not pure evidence.
He push him back into the cave for what he said. It's not clear that that's why.
Correct. He pushes him back because he treats the Jews the way he does the Romans.
Okay.
Right? Meaning, he looks at the Jews. Like I said, it could be, the message is, sure, the Romans you're allowed to look at in a negative light. But Jews, right, you should realize that even when it looks like they're not sincere, right, there's that guy with the two flowers, you know, bunches of flowers that he's getting for Shabbat. Right? That could be the message of the Gemara. Right? My point is that you walk away from the Gemara, and it's not clear who wins. Right? It's not clear that Yehuda is wrong. Right?
Okay.
Right? I mean, that's my point. In the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, God settles the dispute. The Gemara here, you know, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, they're all great people, right? The Romans obviously like Rabbi Yehuda more, but it's not clear that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is right. It's not clear he's wrong either. But you would think that if God said something, everyone should, you know, should sort of follow along. Right? Right? Meaning, it's my point is not that it's clear. My point is that it's not clear. Right? That's the point, is that what's abundantly clear in Avodah Zarah, meaning, in Avodah Zarah, it's abundantly clear that God weighs in, like Rav Shimon bar Yochai. In the Gemara in Shabbat, Rav Shimon bar Yochai says, sure, the non-Jews are terrible because they don't do it for the right reasons. And Rav Yehuda says, no, they're great because they do good things practically. Right? And you walk away from the Gemara, and at best, you don't know if there was a conclusion. Right? At worst, you know that the person who judged the Romans favorably, right, had a better life than the one who didn't, right? So, you know, but that very lack of clarity is problematic if you read all the Agada purely together, because there shouldn't be any unclarity. So, but we'll come back in 1 second to that. Meaning, we'll take a more nuanced approach in a moment. Now, one possibility is to not take a nuanced approach at all. It's just to say, there's a machloket. Right? There's a machloket. Right? As the Gemara in Shabbat is evidence of, there were some members of Chazal who said, look, if people are involved in good things that are good for us, it doesn't matter whether they did it for themselves, whether they do it for us, whether they do it for idealistic reasons, for altruistic reasons, for selfish reasons, for practical reasons, to get votes, to get money, I don't care why they do it. In the end of the day, if people did good things, it's good, and they get rewarded, and that's the end of the story. That's Rabbi Yehuda. Rav Shimon bar Yochai is a purist, and says, no, you want to do good things, you better do it for the right reasons, otherwise it is valueless. And the Gemara in Avodah Zarah is written from a Rav Shimon bar Yochai camp, and therefore it takes that argument, puts it in God's mouth, and says God's settled it. But, as I said to my students, if you take this simple machloket view, what you have to, for the rest of your life, be careful of is what people are often not careful of. Taking an Agadah, using it to make a point, and thinking that's the full picture. Right? Meaning, right? You'll hear this all the time. People will take a single line, right, without thinking about the complexity of Chazal, without thinking about the multi-voices in Chazal, and it doesn't matter if it's Chazal. It could be a Pasuk, it could be Chazal, it could be a Rishon, it could be anything. Right? And they'll present it as if be-all and end-all of what Judaism is. And I said to them, if you believe there can be a machloket in Agadah, you could have a 2-page extensive Agadah in Avodah Zarah telling you a fundamental truth about the world that doesn't mean that Judaism only believes in that. Right? And you have to be careful, right? Because if there's a possibility of a machloket, then you can never be sure from a single text that you know what Judaism holds, the stand of Judaism, which I think is a healthy thing for people to realize, because people don't like doing that. But this is true in Tanakh also, right? Tanakh as well presents different views, right? Not necessarily opposed to each other, but focusing on different things, complicating matters. I remember once when I was a fellow at the Tikva Fund for a year after I finished Yeshiva College. And does anyone know Tova Gansel? No. So Tova Gansel is the head of the Beit Midrash at Midrashah at Bar Ilan. She's a professor of Tanakh at Bar Ilan. So she took a sabbatical and was actually a fellow the same year. Her husband was doing a fellowship at Sloan Kettering. He's an oncologist, I think hematologist-oncologist or something. So she took a year off and did a sabbatical, and she was at the fellowship. And she was writing a book on Yechezkel. As part of her research during that fellowship, I remember she was presenting it. We would all present our research to the group. She said the reason she was writing it was because she has 2 friends in Yerushalayim or in Israel who base their whole worldview on Yeshayahu, right? Because Yeshayahu is the ethical Navi, right? Everything in the world is about ethics. Everything is about tzedek u'mishpat. Everything is about tzedek u'mishpat. And she said, you can't build a whole worldview over Yeshayahu. You can't do it without Yechezkel. I know Yechezkel's hard to read, but you have to look at Yechezkel. Now, she was a bit harsher than I was, right? Because she named those people. I would usually give them smicha. She didn't because they're her friends. But she said, Ani tamid omer liyuval ulebeni. Right? Yuval Shurlo and Beni Lau. Right? You can't build your whole worldview on Yeshayahu. You have to take into account Yechezkel. So I wrote a book to prove to them they have to take Yechezkel seriously. Right? I don't usually do that to convince my friends they need to take something seriously, but fine. But you know, she has a point, right? There are Nevi'im Achronim that say that all of Judaism is about ethics, right, and morality, and there are other Nevi'im Achronim who say it's all about, you know, you read last week's Haftarah, right? It's about you weren't sincere when you brought Karbanot, right? You brought pathetic Karbanot. You don't respect ritual, right? Meaning there's a balance, right? If everyone is ritually frum, but they're not ethical, so you're going to scream about ethics all day. And if everybody is ethical, but they don't respect God, right, in shul, then you're going to scream about talking in shul, right? It's not like, right, you want a holistic view. You can't just pick, you know, you can't just pick one little view and think that's everything. So this position is taken by, I gave it here 6, I won't read it inside, but the Pirkei Kahuna, if you want to look at it later, number 6. On the Pirkei Kahuna, he tries to sort of reduce this to halacha, and he says, look, we know that there's a dispute in halacha, which we call mitzvot tzrichot kavana or mitzvot ein tzrichot kavana. Do mitzvot need proper intent or not? So he says, look, it's a dispute. If you think that in order for a mitzvah to be valuable, you need intent, so then Rishon Bar Yochai is right. And if you take the position that you don't need intent, you can fulfill a mitzvah without intent, so then Yehuda is right, or Yehuda is right, and the two machlokot are just a machloket between those who think mitzvah tzrichot kavana and those who think mitzvah ain't tzrichot kavana. Fine. Right now, it's a bit more complicated. This isn't a formal mitzvah, right? It's just a thing which could be a means, but it's not an end in of itself. But the, you know, as my student said, we don't like that analysis. I said, the point is not the analysis, right? The point is not whether you're convinced by a specific interpretation of why they would argue. The point is, he has no problem saying that there are two drastically different worldviews going on in the period of Chazal. Some who say that we value pragmatism, we value infrastructure, we value everything that people do, whether or not they have the right intent. And another worldview says, no, you got to be a spiritual purist. If you want to do things, you got to have the right intent. You got to understand what you're doing it for. If not, I don't care. Right? You see, Pirkei Kahuna has no problem saying that. Now, the truth is, right, I think at some level, we'll complicate in a moment, but, you know, I sort of identify with the Yehuda, right? Meaning, sure, we like things to be pure, but we know most things are not. That doesn't mean we don't, right, think it's valuable. We just don't, right? We know that, yeah.
Without.
Correct. There could be negative kavana versus neutral kavana. There could be,
like, at times you have more than other times.
For sure.
Maybe
for sure, right? We could have all types of sliding scales, and we could say
the value is not for us to decide. We can't ever know what Hashem's, like, scale is.
Like, perfect. Okay, good. So let me pick up on that. Okay. Let's leave the Pirkei Kahuna aside, right? Let's say we don't want to say it to machloket. How would we read the text together? So we've already started a key. Sorry, remind me your name.
Gila.
So Gila's already started a possible key to resolving these two and saying they're not arguing at all. And that is, who's speaking, right? Who's speaking? And we can say this in different ways. Let's start with the way Ramosha Feinstein says this in number 4. Right, Ramosha Feinstein is on the first page. Ramosha Feinstein in Dibrot Moshe, he picks up on something very subtle, but I think also very important. And he says, "Okay, let's try this again. Who is speaking in the Gemara in Shabbat? Rabbi Yehuda, or in other words, a person. Right? Who is speaking in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah? God. Said, okay, here's this question for you. Let's say that God likes pure intent. Let's say. Does that mean that if someone does a favor for you, you should sit there and say, well, I don't know if I should say thank you. Because, I mean, you did something nice for me, undeniably. But I don't know if you did it for pure motives. You might be expecting me to do you a favor next week, right? So let me, I got to think about whether I trust your motives, right? Now, for sure, if you think that someone is trying to get you, right, so then you'll be very wary, right? But assuming that's not the case, right? It's not that you think someone's out to get you, right? But they might not be purely altruistic, right? A lot of times we do favors for people, sometimes because we're good friends, sometimes because, you know, we know I'll lend you a cup of milk today and you'll lend me an egg tomorrow and whatever. Like, that's just the way we are. You want to call that friendship? You want to call that mutual, right? Helping each other mutually? You know, it's not pure altruism, right? And there's nothing wrong with it. We're all like, I think we're all okay with that, right? We're all okay with the fact that at some level we understand part of friendship is the expectation of reciprocation. Even if we're not there, you know, even if we're not, hopefully we're not the neurotic people who are like, right, you lent me 3 eggs, right, this year, so I will only lend you the monetary equivalent of 3, right? We hope we're not that, right? But, you know, people expect a certain balance, right? If people only give and don't, only take and don't give, we get annoyed, right? There's an expectation of some sort of reciprocity, right? That's just life. So Moshe Feinstein says, wait a second. These Gemaras aren't in conflict. It's very nice for God to say, I want pure intent. But it is chutzpah for a person to say, I am not going to say thank you and appreciate what you're doing because I doubt your intention. Right? Unless you're out to get me, right? I should appreciate what you've done for me. Right, the Gemaras are identical, but there's a huge difference. In one of them, God is saying, what I do in Shamayim, what I take into account in heaven, is my business. But here on earth, Rabbi Yehuda says, you got to say thank you. Right? You've got to appreciate it. I don't care whether it's altruistic or not. Right? Meaning how many people, right? You know, in America, people love quoting Moshe Feinstein, who says that we should have appreciation for America because it's the Medina Shel Chesed. Right, but how many people believe that every politician is doing it purely altruistically? Right, every politician is just a tzaddik. Right, we all know it's not true. We all know they want votes. We all know they want campaign support. We all know that, and we're sort of okay with that because we recognize that's part of life. Right, there's this sort of terrifying book called The Dictator's Handbook by two political scientists at Stanford, something Mesquite, I think. And anyways, it's a fun book. It's a fun book if you get your hand on it. But the thesis of the book is that there is no fundamental difference between democracy and tyranny in terms of what drives them. Because in the end of the day, not everybody, but most politicians, their fundamental goal is to keep themselves in power. The reason that democracies are better societies usually is because they're beholden to more people, so they have to do more good things to maintain power. Right? That's their basic thesis, right? That in a resource wealthy dictatorship, where the dictator controls all the oil, let's say, he doesn't need the people. Right, he needs enough money from the oil to bribe a small group of the army to maintain control. And therefore, he doesn't need to be nice to most people because he can maintain control without being nice. Democracies, because people maintain power through votes, have to do, and they can't, you know, bribe everybody in society. They have to do things for society that's good, that enough people will appreciate, that will then keep them in power. Right? Now, let's say they're right. Right. Let's say they're right, that the average person, the average politician, really just wants to keep themselves in power, but they legitimately do good things. Right. The average good democratically elected leader who wants to stay in power does good things, you know, and let's say a good representative, right, because they don't have term limits, right? They've been in power for 15 terms. And why do they keep getting reelected? Because they keep doing good things for the people, for their constituents, right? Most voters don't at some point wake up and say, you know, that guy, he does it just because he wants to get his next term. And therefore, we should stop voting for him and find the one person who's willing to go into politics just because they're altruistic. They just say, look, the person, there's no corruption. The person has never been indicted, which is quite a feat, right? The person has never done anything that we know of that's unethical. The person seems to be a mensch. The person keeps his or her campaign promises, does good things for our constituency. So let's keep, no one cares, right? And if someone would get up and say, I know deep down you just want to do this because you like being in Congress, and therefore I have no appreciation whatsoever for all the objectively good things you've done for us over the last 30 years, and I have no appreciation for the fact that you kept your nose clean, because I know you just kept your nose clean because you never wanted to get in trouble, right? And you didn't want to lose it, right? Everyone look at them like they're crazy. Like, that's not, you know, that's not how life works. So Moshe, if you look at 4, he says that Avodah Zarah is about God. Right? God can say, I want pure intent. Rabbi Yehuda says it's not true. Right? It's just not true. Now Rabbi Shimon is a purist. Rabbi Shimon isn't willing to say thank you. And as you see, what happens, right? What happens is you aren't willing to appreciate the good that someone does for you, and they have a lot of power, it may not turn out well for you. Right? That's what happens. Right? Now he says Rabbi Shimon had a position here, right? He was willing to take that risk, but still he says it as follows: V'tzarech lomar deni hanidon haya im yesh chiyuv lahakir tova v'nachrim haosim dvarim tovim shelo lishman. Said the issue at hand is whether you have to recognize the good of non-Jews who did good things for you for whatever reason they did it, not for the right reasons. Shavadayaf Rabbi Yehuda yadad osin shelo lishman k'dibreit avreish avodah zarah. He said, for sure, Rabbi Yehuda didn't disagree with the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. He knew that deep down they did it for themselves. And he knew that God would one day come down hard like Rabbi Shimon and say, come on, let's be real, you didn't do it for good reasons. He's not willing to accept the Pirkei Kuna's suggestion there's a machloket, or that Rabbi Yehuda didn't know this philosophy that was floating around. But he said, look, I don't care. They did good things. I don't care why they did it. They did good things. We have to recognize that they did good things for us. And I don't care whether it was for the right reason or not. That's a question for reward in the world to come. Good, I'll leave it to God. Right, leave people's intents to God. Good. L'chein shibech ma'aseihem shel ha'malchut romi shasu kol dverim ha'tovim l'kol ish v'ish. Af shasu shelo chavanah ha'tava li'inshei. And therefore he praised them, what the Romans did, even though they didn't do it for people's sake, for the sake of the Jews. Dein ha'kavanah shelam no gel anu klal. Who cares? Reb Shimon Palig. Reb Shimon was a purist, and he argued, v'sober d'cheven shekol ma'shetiknu ha'ya zel etzorach atzman. He said, since everything they did was for themselves, you don't even got to say thank you, right? You don't have to recognize good. Now, Moshe softens it, because he doesn't want people going around, you know, not appreciating what their friends do for them, because it's not altruistic. He says, look, if a Jew does something good for you, you should appreciate it, even if it's not for the right reason, or pure reasons. Because in the end of the day, even when Jews do things not for the right reasons, we consider it a mitzvah. Right? He has a particular conception that we distinguish in this level between Jews and non-Jews. That's Rav Moshe's conclusion. Then he notes that his son, Rav David Feinstein, wasn't thrilled by this. Because he said, why would you distinguish? The Pasuk says, Lo titaev, right? Mitzri, ki ger ha'ita be'artzo. Right? You can't hate a Mitzri because you were guests there. We were also ended up being slaves there. They even did bad to us. And the Pasuk says it's true. But just because they did evil to you doesn't mean you wipe away the good. Right? You have to have a complex worldview. So David Feinstein says, if we can't hate the Mitzrim, then you're really going to tell me that Reb Shimon believed that? I mean, I don't understand. Like, the Torah itself seems to give value to what non-Jews do also, to the point where even if they do negative things to us, we have to recognize the good. So he says, okay, maybe that's just to lessen the punishment, or maybe that's only talking about Gerim. The context of the pasuk is if a Ger comes from Mitzri, so then we'll look at the good. But if he's still Mitzri, we'll look at the bad. But Ramosha, right, is basically sold on this distinction between man and God, right? Human beings recognize the good other people do for them, even if it's not pure. God can be a purist if he wants. Reb Shimon was a purist, right? But that wasn't the position of Reb Yehuda. And then, you know, he notes that there is a bit of a hole here, because there is evidence that this is true not just of Jews, but of non-Jews as well, that you recognize the good. And like I said, Reb Moshe himself, in his true vote, right, recognizes that. In his true vote, he goes on about America as a Medina Shel Chesed, right? Meaning, and I don't think he felt that every politician was doing it for the most altruistic reasons, but his general approach, I think, right, is a helpful one, not just sort of in life, but it's also helpful methodologically, right? If we come back and look at it from a bird's eye view, right, Reb Moshe, what's Reb Moshe saying? Reb Moshe is saying, look, Agadot, we should assume that they're in conversation, and as much as possible, we should minimize machloket. What is the tool we use to minimize machloket when it seems identical? You look for slight nuances that shift perspective, right? And Reb Moshe said, all it took was recognizing that one is dealing with the question, does God care? And the other is, should people care? And when you realize that those are not the same question, the contradiction evaporates. That's Reb Moshe. The Marsha, if you look at number two, the Marsha as well recognized the tension. And his problem is not, as I said, like Netziv-like, that there's a contradiction between the Gemara. His problem is specifically that Reb Yehuda seems to go against God, right? He doesn't like this. Right, that Reb Shimon Bar Yochai personifies God, so Reb Yehuda is anti-God. Right, he doesn't like that, so he says as follows in number two. He said, "L'chora dvarim Elohim batzmam hit natzlut shalomot latid biyom hadin v'divrei Reb Shimon heim batzmam divrei Hakadosh Baruch Hu leumot lemora olam." Right, it seems like this is the God and the Romans all over again, except that Reb Shimon personifies God and Reb Yehuda personifies the Romans. Kidi behedib beish perakama devadazara. V'tzarach lomar devaday Reb Yehuda nami modeh k'mashak katuv besugyan dehatam sheheishiv lahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu ma asitem l'tzarach atzmechem asitem. So it must be that Reb Yehuda agrees with God. He just, you know, it's just a, that's just a rule, right? You agree with God. Okay. K'damar Reb Shimon HaKadosh Baruch Hu lo kamar Reb Yehuda tiknu shvakim v'chulei klum lo asu lo bishvili Yisrael k'mashak katuv sham shekein yomru umar olam la'atid el Reb Yehuda satam dvarav mipnei yirat ha'malchut v'amar kama na'im. He gives a very simple explanation, which is the Gemara in what? Yeah, right. He says, look, the Gemara. Remember, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah doesn't deny they did good things. It just denies that it's valuable in the ultimate sense. Yehuda was politically smart, and Reb Shimon less. Right? He says the lesson here is in politics. Right? It's not. It's very simple. Sure. Sure, God recognizes what's going on. So did Reb Yehuda. Reb Yehuda was under no delusion, right, of what the Romans were doing. But he was politically savvy. So he said, it's amazing, they build all this infrastructure. He didn't then do the next sentence, which is, but ultimately it doesn't matter, because they did it for the wrong reasons. Right? He was politically smart. And he said, look. And he said, there's no machloket. Right? He said, look, be careful, there's no real machloket. Right? Because... right? He said, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah is asking the question, do you get reward for it? The Gemara in Shabbat is dealing with the question, have they done good things? Right? It's the same way that, you know, when a shul invites their congressman to speak before election day and says, you know, the Jewish community really appreciates the support you've given to Israel, you know, how good you've been in terms of, you know, organizing extra garbage collection before Pesach, right? Whatever they do, nobody thinks that they go out of their way to organize the extra garbage collection before Pesach because like deep down in their soul, they think that this is a great thing to do, right? Like they all recognize that it's because they want votes. But so what? You know, if you want to continue this mutual pragmatic relationship, right? The politician will talk about how much they value the Jewish people as part of their community, and the Jewish community will thank them for all they do for the community. And the fact that we all know that this is just because we need your help and you need our votes, right? Nobody cares, right? You play politics, right? That doesn't mean you don't think the person's a good person, right? You can think the person's a bad person, you can think the person's a good person, it doesn't matter, right? You do it always, right? It's just a certain level of political savvy. So the Marsha says, the lesson between the Gemaras is the Gemara in Avodah Zarah is a spiritual one. Gemara in Shabbat is political. In the world of politics, focus on the good. When it comes to God, he can sort of weigh things out. But that wasn't Rabbi Yehuda cared about. Now the Sfat Emet doesn't like this at all. So the Sfat Emet claims that Rabbi Yehuda never said it. He claims Rabbi Yehuda said it rhetorically, right? Like, he said, you know, b'tmiha, right? It's incredible. Like, how did they end up doing anything good, right? Like, you know, but that doesn't seem to be the pshat here. But you know, the Sfat Emet is also trying to grapple with this question. Okay. If you skip down to number 5, this is a collection that's of sort of random sources, but it's on the Bar Ilan CD, so I can copy and paste it. He also notes this problem. He says, in the world to come, we know they're not getting reward. Mishum kach, or me'achar mikol makom be'emet, yatzah me'em tova, shenitasku Yisrael b'torah, ma be'kach, shasu l'tzorach atzmam. He said, in the end of the day, who cares? In the end of the day, they did good things, so they should get reward. Right? I mean, I don't understand. Why is the Gemara so harsh on them? In Avodah Zarah, as the Gemara in Shabbat indicates, harein nitbayer, shafilum tiyekam adam laveira, mikol makom yesh lam v'kabal schar, even if it was negative, who cares? At some level, there is reward for doing things. V'fra'al if he be'er ayadua shomaran agrizat tzalda tilav v'achein yitgar le'in kol. The Griz, the Brisker Rav, has a piece where he suggests that God says to the Romans in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, you didn't do it for the Jews. But the implication is, according to the Griz, it was for the Jews. You just didn't realize that. Right? Had you realized that, it would have been great. Right? The problem is, as he said, Shotim Shabbat Olam, you didn't realize that what you were doing was valuable, right? It's post facto justification. But he said, if that's the case, that's why God doesn't say you're a liar when they say we did it for the Jews. He just says you were foolish. You had an opportunity to imbue value into what you did. You just didn't bother. And the Rashba, to be fair. Why don't they get reward? So if you skip, first he quotes the Rashba, but if you skip down, he suggests what Gila suggested before, which is, well, maybe there's a sliding scale. And he says, let's be very careful. Gemara in Avodah Zarah was focusing on so far I've sort of simplified it. It's asking, do you get reward in the world to come? That's not actually what the Gemara said. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah said, right, remember the scene?
Who gets to come first?
What? Well, even more than that, right? God is holding the Torah in his heart and saying, who partook of this? Right? And what do they come and say? We did, because we enabled it. So what whoever wrote this piece, it's from Zvi Kreiser, this one, right? He said, you know what the Gemara is doing? The Gemaras aren't contradictory. They're just talking about varying levels of reward. The Gemara in Shabbat tells you, sure, they get reward. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah is asking a very specific question. Is it as if they learned Torah? Meaning, did they actually partake in the Torah? Not did they do good things, but did their good things raise to the level of Kiyum HaTorah? And he said, look, you want to partake of Torah, you either got to learn it, keep it, or actively do practical things, having in mind that you're helping the enterprise of God's Torah. If you don't, it's still good. You still get reward. You still get praised. But you can't claim that you got level one. If you didn't realize the full implications of what you were doing, you know, you just sort of felt like building society was a good thing. So we'll reward you for building society. But Latid Lavo, God isn't just going to ask who gets any reward. He wants to know who gets reward level one, right? Who are the primary people? Who are the people who are considered Mi Bachem Yagid Zod? Who represents my Torah? And there he says, look, either you got to learn Torah, you got to keep Torah, or if you're going to be involved in infrastructure that's going to help Torah and everything it represents, you at least got to believe in the mission. You got to do it for that reason, right? We all know that we have a tremendous amount of respect for Talmidei Chachamim, for the people who spend time doing Chesed, and for the people who support Chesed. Because we believe that they're all in it, they're all focusing on different aspects of the Torah's mission in the world, actively, right? We have appreciation, but less deep respect for, I don't know, the fact that in New York City, the government provides busing to all Jewish schools, because they provide busing to all schools, right? We appreciate it, right? We appreciate that that's part of what New York City pays for, but we don't, like, put on our walls, like, a plaque that says, thank you, right? Even if transportation is a huge cost, right? In the end of the day, the person who donates $50,000, right, once will get a plaque on the wall, and the fact that the government is, you know, investing millions of dollars in transportation every year, you know, we say thank you, and we, you know, vote the politicians in who do it, but we don't put a plaque on the wall that says, you know, the government of New York City. Because we recognize there's appreciation for people who do things who are good, and there's a higher appreciation for people who buy into the mission, right? So this Tzvi Kreiser says that's what's going on. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah isn't denying that there's reward. It's just saying it's not level one. It's not, you can't say, mi bachem yagid zot. You can't say, if you donated money to the cause with full intent, with full cognizance of the implications of what you were doing, you get a plaque on the wall, right? You can be considered the Tomecha Torah. If you passed across the board policy in the government that there should be, transportation, so, you know, Rabbi Yehuda will say you're a great person, thank you, right? You really do get some reward, but you can't claim that you're at the level of the people who bought into the mission. So what you have here, right, is I think several models, right, of how you deal with Agadah, each of which sort of, right, we have to what? 1105? Is that what we said? 1105? No, I wanted to make sure I'm not, that's fine. That I understand. I just want to make sure I'm not going overtime here. 1105, is that what we said, something like that? Ish? 1105, 1110. Right, so you get a few models here, right? You have the Pirkei Kahuna says, look, I have no problem saying Agadot, simply argue on each other. So there are Agadot that believe that if you do things that are good without the right intent, you're evil. And others Agadot who believe if you do things that are good, regardless of intent, you're a good person. Fine. Marsha, I think, doesn't care to say there's machloket. He just doesn't like there being a machloket with God. Right? I think that's probably what's doing it. So he says, they work together, but it's a lesson in politics. Whatever's true in the next world, that doesn't mean you got to say it. Right? Not everything that you think or believe has to be said. Right? Ramosha Feinstein says, no, it's a lesson in Akarat Tov. Right? Ramosha said there's a lesson here. It may be true that in God's world, it won't be recognized as a mitzvah. Who cares? The question in the Gemara and Shabbat is not that. At least according to Yehuda, the question was not, is God going to give them, you know, a seat in the world to come? I don't care. They did something good for me. I got to say thank you. Right? Rav Shimon is a purist. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai is a purist. But he says the machloket isn't one of, like, big theological issues. It's Yehuda says you should be a mensch regardless of what's going on in the next world. That's not your issue. This Zvi Kreiser says, look, I got another one, right? As Gila said, maybe it's just a question of degrees, right? You have to recognize that, yes, there is value to pragmatism and being the, but if you don't buy into the mission, we can't say you're a level one, you're a level two. That's great, but the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, which is talking about Yemot HaMashiach, is talking about when everything comes, you know, everyone doesn't just want to get reward. They want to be level one, right? They want to be front and center. And there God says, look, I'm not denying you did something good. You did. You built whatever you built, right? That's great. But you weren't, right? You weren't the people I put a plaque on the wall for, right? Okay. So that, I think, is a few sort of models of how to deal with it, which, and I think each of them, besides for the local lessons, also shed light on the types of ways in which different mefarshim attack, right, seeming contradiction, or just put text in conversation, right? They complicate the picture, both of how we relate to the non-Jews, how we relate to lack of intent, how we balance Hakar Datov with knowledge of, right, the complexity of God's judgment, right? All those things, right, they see as the implicit messages between the texts, right? The text never articulated any of them, but the implicit messages by putting them in conversation. Okay, we have a few minutes, so let me throw out one or two more points. Okay. One little point in the Gemara that bothers me a bit. Most of the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, if you remember, is pretty neutral, right? The Persians come in, they say, we built infrastructure, God says, that's very nice, but you did it for yourself. Okay, fine. The one part of the Gemara that, at least to me, seems a bit over the top was when God says, oh, you built marketplaces just to put brothels in them, right? It's like, I mean, that's just unnecessary, right? Like, right, he could have just said, you built marketplaces to make money, right? Like, why are we going out of our way to harp on the most negative thing? So Tosfot picks up on this in number 7. And he says, God could have just said, you know, you built marketplaces. You know, it was sufficient to negate their claim that they did it for the Jews to say, no, you did it to make money. That's fine, right? Wall Street doesn't exist, right, so that the Jews can learn Torah. It exists so people can make money. That's fine. Why would you say that you did it so that you have a place for prostitution? But he says, yeah, the Gemara is going out of its way to insult them as much as possible. That's literally the point. It was unnecessary, and the Gemara did it anyways. So why? Right? So here, we find one place in the Gemara where the Gemara actually tells you that it does this explicitly. The Gemara in number 8 tells you about Bilam, that in every other evil person that was discussed earlier in the Gemara, you don't have to believe every midrash. Right? You shouldn't necessarily take every negative thing. Except for Bilam, the comment the Mishkachar Bei Drosh Bei, any possible thing you can find that he did wrong, any drash you could do that makes him look worse, just do it. Just heap on the insults. Whatever you can come up with, right? Every hint you find, any pasuk, murder, right? Avodah Zarah, rape, whatever you want, just find it. Just throw it on him, right? Which is sometimes how we feel with the Agada that does and other people, like Esav, right? All the pasuk says last week's parsha is he comes back from the field, right? Chazal heap on. He was it was his 13th birthday, and to celebrate his bar mitzvah, he worshipped an idol and he slept with a namur, right? He slept with a newly betrothed, right? Nairu Murasa, and he, right, committed murder and avodah zarah, and he was mevazel b'char, right? All in honor of his bar mitzvah, and you're just like, okay, like, whew, right? Like, it's a bit much, right? It's a bit much. Now, there is, to be fair, a claim I heard Uriel Simon quote this from somebody, I'm not sure who though, that Gemara is really not about Esav at all. That Midrash is a rumination on the Jews' situation in Rome, in Roman culture, Rome being personified with a dome, because on the average day, a Roman soldier might actually do that, right? The Roman soldiers were pagans. The Roman soldiers, we know, used to have a law that when a woman was about to get married, she would have to sleep, right, on the night of her wedding with the officer first, right, as a control, right, as a sort of, you know, control play by the Roman soldiers, right? So It's you know, the claim is made that Chazal are really talking about not Esav of Esav. They're talking about safely, right? They're sort of complaining about how bad life has gotten under the Romans, where the average, right, soldier might actually murder, rape, steal, you know, kill, worship of a desire all in the same day. Fine. Which is another thing.
Same,
what?
You just say the same thing about, like, it's almost like in this attempt to reconcile these Gemaras, we're taking them totally out of context also. Why don't we just say, you know, the Gemara of Avodah Zarah is also trying to give you a warning about what can happen in a marketplace.
Oh, for sure. So the Gemara may have...
And that's why that's focusing on that. And,
oh, for sure. So the Gemara might have ancillary concerns.
A real contradiction.
Oh, no, there's no contradiction. I'm not saying there's a contradiction. Here there's no contradiction. There's just a...
In general, the Mefarshim on these Gemaras are sort of highlighting points they want to make. Just like
correct.
Midrash highlights points. And so they create the contradiction in order to highlight a point, whether the point is we're not supposed to judge, only God judges. There is this way in which...
Correct. So it could just be, right, that. I mean, you could have just said, look, okay, so, you know, they're throwing in a message about marketplaces. But right, Tosfot at least believes that no, this was like an active, right? This was active. We wanted to like talk badly about the Romans as much as we could, right? Now, why would we do that? So part of it may have been, as I just said, we're ruminating about, like, that was the reality, right? They just, you know,
or the Gemara wanted to talk bad about the Romans,
right? Meaning it wanted, but why? Okay. So it could just be they don't like the Romans and they're miserable and like, you know, it's cathartic. A possibility. And if it's not true here, it is true elsewhere. I mean, it is true in the Bilam Gemara that I gave you an 8. It is a point that Maritz Chiyas makes. Maritz Chiyas in his Mavola Talmud makes the point that, look, yeah, Midrash is trying to make a point. But what is the point, right? Why is it that every evil person, because not just the Romans, sure, here's the Romans, in the Gemara in Sanhedrin's Bilam, in the Gemara, in, right, in the Midrashim on last week's Parsha, it's Esav, right? It's true of Yishmael. Like, every person who we know is evil goes from being, like, evil to being... very evil, right? And the truth is, the opposite is also true, right? Good people, right? We whitewash their sins, and right, they become the best people ever, right? I mean, that's just the way Midrash works. So, why is that? So, Maritz Chiyas, in many different passages, I don't really have time to read it, but I gave it to you in 9, in many different passages, makes the argument that the reason it does that is for educational purposes. Right, we have to realize the Agadah is making a point. And one of the points you make in life is that good people are good and bad people are bad. I mean, sure, life is more complicated like than that, but you don't do that when you're trying to make a point. If you're trying to make a point, right, how do you make a point? If you think, as the Mishnah says, Avera Gereret Avera, Mitzvah Gereret Mitzvah, that one thing always leads to another. So how do you make that point? By taking someone that we know to be a bad character and heaping everything on it, because you make the point. If you're a little bit evil, it doesn't end with a little bit of evil, it ends up with a lot of evil. Right? And if you're a little bit good, right, that's just the beginning. Don't worry, it'll get better. Right? How do we do that? We oversimplify. Right? We exaggerate. It's not lying, it's an educational tool. And he says you have to look at Midrashim in that light. Sometimes we heap evil on evil people to make a point. Right, not necessarily a historical point, a point, an educational point. Right, I the example I gave to my students, and this is a key if you ever learn Mishle. Ramosha Lichtenstein once said, "Why is it that Mishle everything is simplified? Right, like Kohelet, bad things happen to good people, good things happen to bad people. Everything, right? Mishle, the whole time, it's my son." Be good, avoid bad people, because bad people it never works out for. They get caught, they suffer. Good people, it's all great. Right? Mishle is like the world is black and white. Right? Kohelet, the world is not. Mishle, the world is black and white. So all the Mefarshim will try to figure out, they're both true. Moshe Lichtenstein just said the simple pshat is that is the audience. Kohelet, well, really, Mishle. Mishle is written to children. Shema bini musar avicha ve'al titos terat imecha. Right? It's the simple pshat of Mishle is it is what you teach educationally. And when you start teaching somebody, you start teaching a child, right? You teach things in black and white to make a point. Right? You don't tell your 10-year-old, your 5-year-old child, sometimes if you misbehave, it's really going to work out for you. And sometimes if you do everything right, it's going to be bad. Right? Even though we all know that's true, but first you need to instill the value that doing good things is good and it pays. And we do at some level believe that that's true in like the long scheme. And later in life, we'll complicate the message. But when you want to make a point, you make it as strong as you can, you make it as black and white as you can, and later on, so we'll complicate things. Right? That's Kohelet, right? As he said, Mishle is what we teach, right? Right off the bat. Shema is b'nei musar avicha. Good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people, so do the right thing. Right? That's often the way the Midrash should be read. It's making a point in black and white. It's not the full picture. It's not even the true historical picture. It's making a point. Bad people, it doesn't start, right? It may not have started with murder and rape and whatever, but, you know, once you're on the wrong path, it can get to who knows what. Right? It doesn't always. We know it doesn't always. Right? Sometimes marijuana isn't a gateway drug. And sometimes it is, right? But why do people talk about it as a gateway drug? Because they want to scare people away from it, right? Is it not? I don't want to weigh in on that research, right? I have no idea, right? But why do people focus on that? What's so scary about calling it a gateway, right? Because they're saying it doesn't stop here, right? You think you're just smoking a joint, right? It's not, right? You are going to be You are going to be on heroin before you know it, right? And people are scared of that, so they stay away from the first step, right? So the Midrash does the same thing, right? If you are mevazeh bechora, right? You don't recognize what's valuable in life, the next step is murder. Maybe not, right? But we're making a point, right? Let's glance at it. I won't make the last point. But if you look quickly, he says, Hayagam ki midarchei drush and ahugat lam lachnis and hashim mitchalfim tachat. Now, you know what? Okay, I won't read inside, I'll say his other point. He says that this insight lies behind the non-historical move that Chazal often do, which is to conflate personalities. Right? Right? When they say that all these evil people are the same person and all these righteous people are the same people, right? It's 10 names for the same person, right? They're doing the same thing. Right? Meaning they're making an educational point. Right? At some level, all good people, right? Right? Good people are good people and bad people are bad people. And it doesn't matter. We can go generation to generation. We can, right? We can mix and match. Right, there's at some deep level, right, all good people are good, right, in any generation, and all bad people are bad. There is a certain connecting line. So, again, I don't know if that's exactly what the Gemara is doing here, but I think it is true in general. It's an important to think in Midrash. Midrash is not always, if you want to understand Midrash, you need to understand an Agadah. Got to realize it's not always making a historical claim. Because sometimes you think it's making a historical claim, you'll just wonder, why is it making that claim? It's making a point. It's educating. It's oversimplifying to get a message across. That doesn't mean the Midrash is not aware of the fact that life is more complicated and that people can be both good and bad. Right? It's the same way, as I said, that we tell our kids, do the right thing and it'll be good for you. Right? Try in school. Right? And then you'll get a good job or whatever. Right? We know that there are people who tried hard in school and got a good education, don't have a good job, and people didn't try at all, right? And locked out. We know that. But we also think that it's better for our kids to work in school and it will increase their chances, right? And as long as we can get away with oversimplifying the message to get them to do the right thing, we will, right? When it comes time to complicate the message, right, and they find that they see people who had good job, didn't get a good job, even though they tried hard in school, okay, we'll deal with it when it comes, right? That doesn't mean there isn't a certain element of truth in the black and white, right? And like I said, the Maritzchias thinks that that's why we sort of throw the evil on the evil and the good on the good, and also sometimes even collapse personalities to do that. Okay, so those are two different things that we learn more from the Sagarata, more from zeroing on local things. Okay.